ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to The Screen Show. It's Jason DeRosso with you once again. A festive edition this week because, of course, we're going to air for the first time at least on Christmas Day, and that's when we're releasing the podcast as well. And I have some new interviews for films releasing in cinemas this week. Holiday films. And a little throwback later on to an interview I did earlier in the year about a small screen favourite of mine that I think is worth checking out over summer if you haven't already seen it or even revisiting it. But we're starting with Song Sung Blue, which is a film starring my first guests, Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson. It's a film about a real life couple whose tribute act to Neil Diamond became a sensation in their hometown of Milwaukee. Mike and Claire, stage names Lightning and Thunder, meet on the musical impersonator circuit. They don't just do Neil Diamond songs. They're both battle-scarred from divorces and single-parenting teenagers. Life's thrown them a few curveballs, let's say. And Mike is also a recovering alcoholic. Together, they decide to join forces musically and offstage as well. They start an unconventional Neil Diamond tribute show in that, well, there's two of them, and one of them's a woman. And they also have quite an unorthodox approach to his back catalogue. They decide that they prefer playing some of his lesser-known songs instead of leaning on the big hits like Sweet Caroline. And in this, I think the film is an interesting way to celebrate tribute acts, not just as some empty mimicry, but as a creative response and an interpretation of an artist's work. Certainly, Lightning and Thunder do take their show, the choreography of it, the costumes, and the editorial decisions of just which songs to highlight and which to not play very, very seriously. And so it is that they start to attract some very discerning fans, including grunge frontman Eddie Vedder. Song Sung Blue tells this story with lots of vibrant roving camera work. It's directed by Craig Brewer. Now, he made the rags to riches hip-hop film Hustle and Flow a few years ago, so he has a great empathy for the graft of musicians as they search for that lightning in a bottle moment in a performance. It's a film visually that is full of strong contrasting textures. It's a film of sweat and sequins, hairsprayed bouffants, and grease under the fingernails. By the way, it just so happens that Mike is also a trained mechanic. Both Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson are proven entertainers with blue-collar suburban characters like this. They embody the everyday courage and optimism of the story, and they have the range to embrace its very dark edges, because tragedy knocks the wind from their sails midway through the movie. And how these two cope with the catastrophe that befalls them is the film's ultimate focus. It turns out, of course, that they cope by leaning on each other and on the music. Kate Hudson and Hugh Jackman are indeed a formidable double act in this movie. They're coming up. But first, let's hear a taste of it. And yes, of course, it's ironic given what I've just said, but to be expected that there's one song in particular that's used pretty heavily in the trailer.
I'm not a songwriter, I'm not a sex symbol, but I am an entertainer.
I don't want to be a hairdresser, I want to sing, I want to dance, I want to be able to say, look at me, I made it.
Look at the night.
You're supposed to be Loretta Lynn?
Oh, Patsy Cline. My boobs were just a bit bigger, I could be Dolly.
You're a blonde?
Oh boy, am I.
I can begin to know when.
You know who you'd be perfect for? Neil Diamond.
We fill it up with only two.
We should call ourselves Lightning and Thunder.
Are you good? Are you ready?
I'm huge, baby.
Just to warn you, to make it loud.
Hugh and Kate, welcome to The Screen Show.
No,
hi.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
You share such a great chemistry on screen. I wanted to ask, first of all, how do you go about building that kind of rapport?
Well, with Kate, you just hang out with her. I remember Kate on day one. We did a reading. which is the only reading I've ever gone to where people were crying at the end of it, like a table read. And I remember we sat there, we were just having a sandwich and people were walking around, and Kate turned to me and said, you know, this movie only works if we work.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, it's very much a love story about this 1 + 1 = 3. Like the two people come and rescue each other and they build this family. But with Kate, I have to say it was easy. It was just easy. I like to get to know people. I like people to get to know me. And with some people, that's hard. But with Kate, she's just so curious. And we kind of knew everything about each other within about an hour.
Right away.
Did you record the music first?
Yeah.
So did that help? Must have helped.
It was nice. It's definitely like a, you know, that throwing you into the most awkward situation, you know, because music really can be that awkward first date feeling. You know, you don't know how your voices are going to sound together, or if you're going to, how someone, singing is a very vulnerable thing. So,
yeah,
but again, it was just easy.
You pick up on something really important. I don't know if I've told you this, but I've never really felt comfortable recording because I started singing in theatre. So that's how I knew singing. And the moment I put these on, I didn't like it. And I've always had a troubled relationship with it. And I think you came in and were so at home. Like it was your happy place being in that recording studio. And I thought, I'm just going to have to be honest with it, Kate. And so I did. I said, I feel a bit nervous. I don't feel like this is my zone. I'm not nervous about this part. And you just immediately, you held it. And that's when I knew I could trust you.
Because it's interesting, the way it's shot, you know, there is this sort of organic feel in some of these scenes, almost a documentary feel. And the film has such a grit to it. Maybe we could talk about why that is. I mean, the locations feel very real. They sort of feel like practical locations. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about how it was shot and how it was all sort of choreographed so that we do get this feeling from the screen. It just comes, this authenticity, I suppose, emotionally.
It was all real locations. There were no stages. It was all done on location. And, you know, Craig has a really great ability to make music movies or movies that honor music. He has, as Jim Belushi said, the soul of a musician. And I think with that comes an ease for him in the choreography and the rawness of shooting music, backstage. He spent a lot of time. He lives in Memphis. He's Memphis, Tennessee. If anybody has spent time there, it is a music town. Grew up with jazz cats, blues cats, country, like, you know, musicians. Like he is almost more of a, as he would say, musician than a filmmaker in his soul. So his ability to create that rawness or to capture it, I think, is sort of second nature to him. Like he's so in his pocket in this movie.
Some of the direction you would give us, like, a little less butter on the toast, guys, a little less butter on the toast. and we would sing live. So he would mic us to be live and we recorded it. So there was this feeling of we're going to really do it. We're going to capture something. If you remember Hustle and Flow, that really magic moment where all of a sudden Taraji P. Henson is recording and, oh, something's happening. Something magic, you watch it happen. And so like the scene in the house where they first sing together, I think Craig just knows how to do that. And he creates, I guess, it has to be real, right? And times it's elevated because we've got performance, but really it's grounded in reality. And that's where the magic comes from in the way he shot it.
And I think too, Hugh as a performer and me as a musician, like, the understanding of a keyboard, the understanding how to play, you know, I can read music. Like, I think he knew. It's like, and everybody that he cast, like all music people. And so there's like this sort of understanding of the world that, you know, is important to Craig and you know, I think really comes across.
I mean, I think the other thing that really comes across in the film is that obviously Neil Diamond is this kind of irony-free zone in a sense. His heyday was in this era of the 70s with the sequins and the hair that was a real kind of flamboyant glamour, but he was also very macho. And I'm wondering about if you could both talk about kind of what that sort of unreconstructed, very flamboyant, macho fantasy means to both your characters. Because obviously subsequently people love Neil Diamond, but there's always a bit of tongue-in-cheek in that love, I feel. But for your characters and the generation of your characters, that's not the case. And I like the way that the film doesn't kind of, it's not snobby about that.
No, that's really well said. Certainly for my character, he just loves him. And he feels Neil's music saved his life. So he's a recovering addict, Vietnam, tunnel rat, you know, a lot of trauma. And it was Neil's songs that got him through the hard times. And he gets very defensive for Neil when anyone's just like, oh, Sweet Caroline. He's like, ah, so much more. Like, I am, I said, like, play me all these incredible songs. And I think it's interesting. I'm flashing back to, I talked to Eddie Vedder about that concert, and Eddie told me that, I said, why did you choose Lightning and Thunder? And he said, I heard from a local muso professional who said, you guys, it's going to sound weird, but these guys have it's Patsy Cline, Neil Diamond, but it works. And you think, are they making fun of it, or is it for real? It's completely for real. Then these guys were, and you could feel it. Everything was actually, they were real artists.
But because it's a film really about the redemptive quality of American popular culture in a way that does predate a kind of postmodern sort of irony, doesn't it? Do you think, Kate, I mean, how do you view it? I mean, your character, you exude so much joy on screen. I mean, there's a lot of darkness in this film. There's addiction. There's all sorts of things. But when you're playing the music and connecting with it, you in your sequence, you exude so much joy.
Mm. Thank you. I want to answer your question really, really thoughtfully. So, will you give me the question again?
Well, do you think it's a celebration of the kind of redemptive power of American popular music and popular culture?
Yeah. Yes. I think it's that, but I also think it's a celebration of the unit. You know, it's about music, and it's just as much about Neil and sort of this love and connection to music and how it can change people's lives. Because that is, I mean, I know it changed it. Music has changed my life multiple times throughout my life. One song, one artist, you know, but I think that this is sort of takes all of those, that theme and, you know, redemption, you know, and feeling like, you know, how do you have to do it. You have to do it yourself. You have to believe in yourself. And you also need a family to believe in you. And I think, you know, why does the collective fan want to go have a collective experience with one artist? You know, it's because they feel like they belong. And when Mike and Claire meet each other, they feel like they have something to believe in, and they finally belong to each other, you know, and then they create this family and these friend group and these people that are all there to root for each other. So I think thematically, it's not just about pop culture. I think it's about also the sort of individual experiences of redemption and starting over and second chances and, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful film. Great performances from you two that really, you know, ground the film so beautifully. So thanks very much for talking to me.
My pleasure, Jason.
Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson, who share some really great chemistry on screen in the musical romantic drama, Song Sung Blue, in cinemas now. You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. The Christmas edition. Now, thinking about romantic dramas, one of the best of recent years also had one of the strangest names. It was called The Worst Person in the World. And it's worth tracking down if you haven't seen it. It came out in 2021 and was a time-shifting drama about young people falling in love. It was about fate and it was about tragedy. The film's director, the Norwegian Joachim Trier, and its star, Renate Rensve, who's an exceptional actor, and now back with a film called Sentimental Value. another movie about fate that plays with time, but it's less about romantic love and more focused on family and historical trauma. In particular, it's about two sisters in their 30s, Nora, an actor, and Agnes, a historian, and their very dysfunctional relationship with their very famous filmmaker dad, Gustav. Renata plays Nora. She's a well-respected and successful performer, but she suffers debilitating stage fright. Her condition is depicted in an exciting early scene where she's preparing to take to the stage at the National Theatre in Oslo and is suddenly compelled to run from the building. Her dad, Gustav, played by an excellent Stellan Skarsgård, is a man in the twilight of his filmmaking career, but he wants to make another film, and his laser focus makes him a rather self-obsessed and oblivious father figure. The film he wants to make traces the family's history to the war and is about a suicide whose aftershocks still reverberate. Although perhaps neither he nor Nora nor Agnes realise to what extent. Making the film is, of course, a way to understand this tragedy in their history. There's a role for Nora in it, but she refuses to act in her father's projects. So Gustav invites a big-name American actor, played by Elle Fanning, to come to Norway to read some lines for the lead role instead. And her outsider's perspective on these long-running familial animosities proves pivotal. Central to the film is a beautiful location, a carved wooden two-story house in the middle of the city, which has been in the family for generations and is also where the suicide of their ancestor took place. It's a physical reminder that the past haunts the present. The film is asking a clear question: how do we live with the trauma of the past in a way that doesn't paralyze us? How do we deal with it in a way that won't poison our present-day relationships? Skarsgård is particularly memorable as the film's primary instigator. Gustav really is the character who gets the ball rolling plot-wise. And he's even perhaps a villain, although Skarsgård deftly modulates his performance as his character slowly wakes up to himself. This is a film partly about Gustav's vanity and how his daughters, his American lead actress, and others will humble him. There's a great moment where Gustav tracks down an old buddy, a cinematographer that he wants to work on this new film, who's now retired to a chic modernist house somewhere out of town, and walks with a cane. Gustav is shocked to see his friend unable to walk unaided, and Trier gives us a brief close-up when he first notices the cane. Gustav almost recoils at the sight. It's a wonderful, subtle reaction shot that speaks volumes about Gustav's fear of aging, of losing his virility and power as a filmmaker. Ingmar Bergman comes to mind. Sentimental Value is a film about filmmaking, and the movie that Gustav wants to make, the film within this film, is not, however, a mere vanity project. Gustav's instinct, his artistic compulsion, is based on something noble. This is, it turns out, a story that needs to be told. But to tell the story properly, to make good art, and to make amends, requires humility. Sentimental Value is a sophisticated and profound film. It won the Grand Prix or second prize of the Cannes competition, an honour it fully deserves. Joachim Trier, the director, is next.
Why didn't you want to do the role? He wanted you to do it.
I can't work with him. We can't really talk.
My father is a very difficult person.
Joachim Trier, this is yet another film where I think your skill as a director dealing with the psychology of characters is so evident, but especially female characters, it seems to me. And I'd like to begin by asking you about the character of Nora, played by Renata Rensve, and where she comes from, this character.
So I think the character of Nora comes from many places. When I write with Eskil Fugt, there's always a variety of motivations. One of them was to work with Renata Rensve again. After The Worst Person in the World, I know her very well, and I had a feeling as a director that I could see her portray Nora as a more mature character. There's a naivete to Julie that Nora doesn't have. But I also think Nora was an opportunity to talk about someone who has a lot of animosity and anger towards her father and is in a strange way also very much like him. And why is she so different from her younger sister, Agnes, as we see in the film? And those dynamics of the family was very intriguing, we thought. And in myself, I mean, I think when I was younger, I was much more assured, at least in my 30s, about what I wanted to do. I wanted to make films, and Nora wants to be an actor, and I can identify with that. But the difficulty then of creating a life outside, a family outside, and I think that's really something we want to explore here. What is that longing for a home and a place of connectedness that Nora is missing?
Yeah. When did the house become such a central focus for this story? Was it always the idea of the house? Because it is such a great cinematic device, the notion of a house as a kind of camera, really, that frames human existence.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for bringing up the house. It's very essential. It came quite late. It gave suddenly a key when we were creating the script here for a perspective of time. You know, when I was a child, I remember watching a documentary about how time is relative to the size of animals. Like for a fly, we move very slow. For an elephant, humans move very quick and so forth. So we thought, what would this family's history look like from the perspective of the building, the house that they've lived in? And it gave us a kind of funny essayistic way into the story. It's a portrayal there for that first beat about the 20th century in a house and the way the Second World War, for example, affects a family and all that stuff. All the stuff that has happened in the same rooms, the joy and the sadness, you know. But it was also like an idea that since the core of the film is not about the house, it's about family dynamics, that the house would show us how quick a human life is. And that was interesting in terms of the story of reconciliation. These two adult daughters, Agnes and Nora, they don't have an eternity to try to figure out what they got and what they didn't get from their father and how they feel about that. So I thought that was a nice framework for the story.
Yeah. I mean, it is a film that I think ultimately is quite a hopeful film, strangely. And Stellan Skarsgård's so wonderful as this quite overbearing and sometimes impossible father figure who wasn't a great father, but is this well-known director who's had quite a lot of success, but is now old and perhaps doubting himself. And he wants to make this, well, who knows if it's his final film, but he wants to make another film. And it strikes me that ultimately, for all his flaws and the flaws of the other characters, without giving anything away, I think it's quite an optimistic film about perhaps the role of art. And it strikes me that you're a filmmaker who does process a lot of your own personal stuff through your work.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're onto something there in your description of it. I'm always hesitant when I speak about this is a film about artists, you know, the father is a director and one of the daughters is an actor. And I'm worried that people feel it's exclusive or that, oh, this is only a story for people who are interested in artistic endeavors or something. And it's not. I think that what I was interested in exploring is that there is an alternative emotional language in art that we all have in us. You know, I have two young daughters who are very tiny and, you know, they sing and dance even before they could speak. They express themselves in other ways. And I think even if Gustav Borg, this weird, difficult father character, even if he's clumsy and sometimes very narcissistic, in him is a hurt child that's trying to express something through art. And I think this is very often how it is. And this gave us kind of a way into their conscious, into a deeper level of communication or discommunication, if you want, that we could play around with in the film here. And I hope that people can recognize, even if they're not from an artistic family, like all that unspokenness, all the stuff you in psychology call transference. You know, you try as a parent to say the right thing and do the right thing, but ultimately you will at some point also fail and expose children to your vulnerabilities, to your shortcomings. And I think seeing that from two generations as a discourse in the film was kind of fun to play around with.
Well, it's an absolutely delicious situation you've got dramatically, that you have a very accomplished actor daughter, Nora, played by Renata Rezeve, who nevertheless does not want to star in her father's film, cannot bear the thought of working with him, and therefore he goes along with this fantasy that maybe he can get a top American actress in to play the role that clearly he's kind of written for his own daughter. So it's great. And in comes Ellie Fanning. And it strikes me here that there is something Hitchcockian about this sort of doubling of the female figure in the film and the film within the film and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, I know that one of your favorite films is Vertigo, and maybe there's a touch of Vertigo in this.
Yeah, maybe a more human scale, humoristic and sad kind of version of that in a Norwegian reality. I of course, adore Hitchcock and love Vertigo. But I think what at the core of Vertigo is also the story about the dangers of control and our yearning to control everything because we're scared of dying. And in this case, in our film, I think more than the question only of mortality and this actor played by Stellan, who's in his 70s, and of course is feeling that life is sort of ending if he can't make another film, there's also this yearning for connectedness and to be a better father than he's been able to be. And poor Elle Fanning's character, Rachel, the star that comes into this family drama without having any clue what she's ended up in the middle of, and also trying to see the humor and the possibility to have some fun with the dynamic that suddenly, you know, the daughter has said no, and then suddenly she's easily replaced by this bigger star, and you know what all that happens with that.
And yet the big star at a certain point in rehearsals stops and the penny drops and she goes, oh, I have stumbled into this long-running family dynamic that is completely dysfunctional, and this film is perhaps going to be a really bad if I continue on with it. It's
the whole complexity of that. And then also there's the question of the sort of sibling situation with the younger sister who used to be an actor, Agnes, and certainly didn't want to be a part of it. And her kind
of child actor, that's right. And she actually has appeared as a child in one of her father's early films, yes.
Yeah. It was kind of fun to play because I also had to make films within the film, and I had to be a much better director than I'm sure I am, to try to be Gustav Borg and do these complicated scenes without editing inside moving trains with weeping children.
That was a very impressive shot. Board. Yes, it's you've created a couple of kids running through a cornfield or something, running away from Nazis. It's a period picture, and they get onto the train, and we're looking at everything from the train that then starts moving. Very congratulations.
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, trying to flex my muscles a bit with the type of film language that I've grown up adoring, you know, great masters like Tarkovsky and, you know, Bellatar and stuff, and that, of course, I have tremendous respect for, and then suddenly trying to do more that kind of style cinema to pretend to make Gustav Borg movies was... It was really fun and a great thing. I must also say, I mean, in a way, the film is a bit of a love letter to cinema. We see all the period pieces in the house through the ages in these montage sequences, and we use different lenses, different film stocks, and try to talk about how film develops, you know, through time. Mm-hmm. So all those meta aspects of it is also something, since I know maybe some of your listeners are film fans, you know, that's kind of something I'm trying to play around with a bit in this one.
Tell me about your grandfather. You come from a film family. Your grandfather in particular was a film director, but during the war, he was a member of the resistance and spent time in the camps. This is a film where the shadow of history is also looming over this family. And namely, there's an ancestor who spent time in the camps, and there's a darkness there about her experience and how that intergenerational trauma is, you know, resonating to the present day. So tell me about the influence of your grandfather on this story and on this film.
Yeah, no, I realize more and more as I'm now releasing the film and talking about it, how central that has been for me. You know, you discover what you do while you do it. To give a bit of context, Erik Løken was my grandfather. He was, as you say, captured during the war, and he was in the resistance and managed to survive. And after the war, became a jazz musician, and then made one film in 1960 that went to Cannes called The Hunt. And he kind of made it in a bit of a nouvelle vague style without knowing what the new wave was at all. He called it a jazz movie as he appeared suddenly in Cannes with people embracing his style as modern and relevant. You know, he thought he was doing his own thing in a way. And there's got some beauty in him trying to get back to life through creating something, feeling connectedness through art. So that's a very specific experience I have of that. But then, as I have become a father myself, and I see with age how his experience during the war has affected my parents and me in subtle and indirect and sometimes direct ways as well. You ask yourself, how many generations does war trauma take? You know, is it three? Will I transfer to my children now that that generation has passed away? We owe them to remember, but we also owe them to move on with life. And that ambivalence of the historical memory, I think, is something I want to talk about in this film.
Yeah, I think the film talks about it very eloquently. And can I say, I really love the opening scene where confronted with a panic attack, which is really quite impactful, as we say. And because we see Nora preparing to go on stage in some kind of very big production, kind of arty production, you know, very high end at probably one of the biggest theatre houses of the city. And she's absolutely losing it. And the assistant directors and various sort of backstage staff are running around trying to stop her from basically running out the, you know, backstage door. And it struck me that it's such an interesting element of her character that you've conjured there. And I suppose it's too obvious to say that this is some sort of metaphor for her, you know, for this intergenerational trauma. But I guess in some ways it is.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, stage fright interests me because I'm a creative person myself and I have a lot of fear of failure. It's not live in the same way as a performer. For me, it's more about, you know, how will my screenplay turn out and how will I make the film? And each second day you think is brilliant or shit, depending on, you know, the day. It's how it is to create. So I think many of us can identify with that. But what I'm also interested in is what drives people who are so anxious and nervous. I mean, I've seen a friend of mine was playing Hamlet and he vomited before the premiere. You know, he wanted to do it, but at the same time he threw up. He was so scared and anxious, and then he went and did a fantastic performance. So the question is this, I think in psychology you call it approach avoidance. It's a very human thing, isn't it? That we both want something and we want the hell to get away from it. You could use that as a metaphor for many things in life. So I was interested in exploring that. And it was a fun way to open the film with that kind of energy also. And it says a lot about, as you say, about Nora as a character, her deep yearning to be seen, to be on stage, to perform, and yet her deep anxiety to open up her emotionality to get there.
Can you tell me if that the house that does feature in the film, which is kind of a strange house for an Australian audience to look at, perhaps, it's wooden, it's frequently, you know, in snow, in the periods of winter that you show the house in, but it looks a bit like what we'd call a gingerbread house, a kind of fairy tale house, but it's in an urban setting. Is it a real house?
Yeah, it is. And they're quite normal over here. And I'm speaking to you from Oslo here in Norway. And it's called kind of a villa, a Swiss-style dragon villa with little ornaments, wooden houses. You know, Norway has a lot of woods and to build from timber and wood, it has been a tradition. And we have even old churches that are very particular that was built in that kind of similar style. So this is a real house. And it as it turned out, there was a quite a famous rock musician in the 80s and 90s. He's still around playing wonderful music in a band called De Lillos. And basically he lived in the house and he was aware of my film. So when we fell in love with it, the house, he was very kindly moved out for a while so we can film there.
Wow. Well, it is a beautiful house. It's just one other reason to go and see this film, which is beautiful in many ways, but very rich, I think, and layered. So congratulations on it. It's been great speaking to you about it.
Thank you so much.
Joachim Trier, filmmaker, his profound, moving, and at times also actually pretty funny film, Sentimental Value, is out in cinemas now. I recommend it to you. You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso. Finally this week to the small screen and an Apple TV romantic comedy series that I really enjoyed when I watched it earlier in the year. It's called Platonic. The second season came out this year. It stars Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen as a pair of friends living in sunny California. He's a marketing guy. She's an events planner. And at the beginning of the second season, she's organizing his wedding to a woman that he probably shouldn't be marrying. Now, I hadn't seen the first season. I wasn't already a fan. But as a newcomer to the show, I found that it began as an easy watch. It was full of relatable gags around social anxiety, middle-age dilemmas, observations about the futility of so many work-related tasks that we find ourselves compelled to carry out. But then as the season unfolds, I think it gets funnier and funnier. There are really some very clever sequences of laugh-out-loud hilarity. I think husband and wife showrunners and directors Nicola Stoller and Francesca Del Banco have an excellent radar for physical comedy and the cringe dimension of modern life, and they're coming up.
Hey, Pinguini, how's it going?
Oh, I love you too, sweetie.
Bye.
You love me, Pinguini. Hey, Pinguini.
What? Come on.
I think I feel intimidated by your friendship with Sylvia.
How are you gonna move this bad boy?
You get the front, I'll get the back.
That's what she said.
Booyah. Yeah!
Ah! You should have seen how far you flew. It was incredible. If you have a ring camera or something, you could go viral, like be famous.
Will and I always get screwy when he's in a couple. I don't want to lose him again. If I were to replace him now, it would take 25 years for me and this new friend to catch up to where Will and I are. And by then, I'm practically dead and who cares? Uh-huh.
If we want to stay friends this time, then we're going to have to do normal adult stuff, like couples dinners and stuff like that.
Fine.
Yeah.
Couples dinners on.
She got any dietary restrictions?
She says she's allergic to gluten, but she's not.
What am I supposed to do with
it? Same thing I do with it. Nothing.
Awesome.
Nicholas and Francesca, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's so unusual to see a friendship like this portrayed on screen between a man and a woman, especially when one of them, at least, is happily married. As the title of the show suggests, right, it's a platonic relationship. And it seems like it's a relationship that affords them both a kind of cone of honesty, a full disclosure kind of brutal honesty, a zone for them both. How do you describe the function that this friendship has for both Sylvia and Will?
I think brutal honesty is a good place to start, as you put it. We think of it as such an old friendship that they have known each other and seen each other through a lot of their best and worst moments as people and as friends. And so they have a kind of like deep well of history to draw on when they see each other making poor decisions or good decisions. And they can kind of call each other out on patterns or habits or things that they do that might not be their best, you know, moves in life, and be honest with each other and be excited for each other's triumphs and also there for each other's like humiliations and failures.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, if I think back to the sitcoms that I grew up with, they seem to fall into two categories growing up, especially in the 80s with, you know, shows like Family Ties. There were shows about the family unit where the responsibilities of adulthood weren't really questioned. The comedy came out of the situation of the family. And then there were shows about single people like Friends or Seinfeld, where the comedy comes out of the volatility, I suppose, of single life and career ups and downs and dating. And this seems to be a very sort of contemporary, I suppose, meld of both sensibilities. Were you kind of aware of that moving into it?
I think that we knew we wanted to tell us that what the story that hadn't been told was just a story about a male-female friendship. Like, that doesn't turn into anything else. It's not like, you know, on Friends, there were certainly among that group various couplings that were just friends, but for a lot of it was romantic, you know. The most famous platonic movie is When Harry Met Sally, which is not platonic at all. It's a romance, you know, and so with this one, we wanted it to be really get into the weeds of friendship and really an exploration of friendship. And then in addition to that, the show is an exploration of midlife And so we wanted, you know, the issues and the problems that these two characters are going through to be specific to that age.
Yeah, and I think your question sort of raises something that we find interesting too, which is that a lot of sitcoms don't really reflect the midlife that we know. You know, as you said, it's not just 80s sitcoms. I think it's a lot of sitcoms now where it's like the parents are happily married and their biggest problem is that they're like harried and need a night away from the kids. They don't have any kind of existential doubts or feelings of like dissatisfaction with their life or any of the kinds of questions that we're accustomed to seeing about shows about people in their 20s. It's like, it's almost as if in TV world, like once you get married and have kids, you're just good. And that's all there.
Or it's very dramatic and you've lost your job and you haven't told your wife and now you're robbing.
No, which totally.
Not like the experience of a lot of people I know, which is, there's a grind, but it's also joyous, but you're also freaked out all the time. But you're also, you know, there's a lot of things that, you know, that I think can be explored in a comedic way that just generally isn't.
Yeah. I mean, you think of something like Everybody Loves Raymond, right? And he's just got this, what in today's economy would be an ideal job in legacy media as a sports journalist, I think. And you know, that's never a problem. There's never an issue. And even in kind of the old fashioned, what was that Candace Bergman show?
Murphy Brown,
yeah. Right, where they are ostensibly work comedies. Work never seemed to get in the way. And I find that this is a show about people living through middle age, and it's a much more dynamic middle age than we're used to seeing. And it's demanding and stimulating because of the economic environment and the volatility of careers. But I guess social media has ramped up that volatility as well, in the way that there's this sense of needing to keep up in middle age that perhaps is not an element present in other sitcoms and depictions of middle age traditionally.
That's great. Happy to hear it. Yeah. I mean, I also think there's something particular about, well, no, it's true for both of the characters differently, but like Sylvia's version of middle age, they're so often on sitcoms, it's like the happy, harried mom who like might be annoyed at certain things about her kids, but doesn't ever seem to be annoyed at like the culture and society for putting her into a box where all she is the mom. So we felt like that was pretty important too.
How different is it? And Nicholas, perhaps I put this question to you first, in terms of someone who's done so many films. Get Him to the Greek was another film that used, you know, your two lead cast members, you know, Rose Byrne and Seth Rogen, but a whole heap of films you've made. How different is making sort of serial comedy TV to making feature comedies for theatrical release?
You know, it's not substantially different, honestly. The writing is different. Like when I'm working on a movie, I'm usually working by myself or one other person. With Platonic, obviously the two of us are writing everything together, but then we also have a writer's room, and it's many months of, you know, cracking 10 episodes of television, like 5 hours is a lot more than doing a movie. And you have less time to do it in. You have less time to shoot, so you have to be a bit more efficient. But there's kind of a freedom with it. It's actually changed the way I've approached a little bit, changed the way I've approached movies, where I move more swiftly now. Not that I was ever slow, but I move more quickly when I'm shooting a movie. So it's not, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about this and Seth Rogen was saying that like a number of years ago, a show like this could have potentially been a movie. You know, it's just like not right now, a lot of comedy, an R-rated comedy has moved to TV and to streaming. And so from the theater. So I don't think it's substantially different, but the writing is different. The narrative, TV narrative is different. It's a bit more open-ended, and you can, you know, the stories don't have to be quite as giant and quite as high concept as the movie is.
Yeah, there's a lot of physicality to this particular brand of comedy as well, which I really enjoy. There's a golf ball to the face at one point. I mean, there's which we won't perhaps reveal, but there are various things. I guess the old, you know, the traditional term, the conventional term was pratfall. There's a lot of physical comedy, basically, that I assume sometimes involves digital effects and certainly stunt people and yada yada, and practical effects too. Tell me about that.
I mean, the golf ball certainly does involve all of the above. Yeah, I mean, that is a big part of the ingredient of this show, is that it's very grounded. We were just discussing all the things about midlife that the show is really about. But then there's kind of like some good old fashioned like comedy set pieces where people do ridiculous things like walk through plate glass windows or have all kinds of, I don't want to spoil anything from season two, but we find that combination kind of compelling, you know, where it's like you see your real life reflected and it's hard and it's gloomy and it's funny. And then something totally crazy and unexpected happens that maybe hopefully makes you laugh out loud.
Yeah, I mean, I like one of my favorite directors is Alexander Payne. And I think his movies, like if you think about Sideways, like, or Election or whatever, I mean, in Election in the third act, Matthew Broderick gets a bee in his eye and like has a giant like bee, you know. And so I think it's like is broad, like there's he goes for broad stuff. And I think we like to do character driven, like story driven, you know, comedy set pieces. Like we want this half hour comedy to be one of those comedies where you actually laugh out loud, not a non-laughing comedy.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a gentle laugh. It's a laugh out loud comedy.
And like I think,
and I think it's from the same episode when I say as the golf ball, when I say that there's an incredibly funny sequence that recreates, a wet dream basically in the mind of a middle-aged man. And it's very funny.
Yeah. But you know, like if you think of the golf ball episode, I mean, that is such it's very broad situation, like the way it's shot, and it's such a silly idea and it's obviously disgusting and there's some gross out humor, et cetera. But we try, it's in there because it creates what we think of as this kind of like very heightened but kind of emotionally real bind that Seth's character then finds himself in, where it's like he feels guilty and beholden because of an accident and he doesn't know how to get himself out of it. So like some real emotional stuff turns on this totally silly thing but it isn't just silly for the sake of being gross or silly. It's silly because it like turns the plot back to a real problem that those characters have.
I mean, I quite like also the soundtrack. Every now and again, you've got these really choice cuts that are the sort of music that you hear in various establishments. I mean, Seth Rogen's character is working for a kind of alehouse set up and is it like a PR dude. And I also, by the way, just as an aside, I love the way that everyone's kind of just involved in the service economy to a certain degree, not service in terms of serving, but you know, their PR people or their wedding planners or even lawyers in a sense. There's this sense that no one's actually making anything with their hands. It's all conceptual and kind of based on ego a little bit. You know, there's a lot of reputation riding on the performance in these careers. But you know, some of the songs from the 90s that pop up or even the early noughts, I feel have been chosen for their comedic value but also a kind of that recognizable moment in a sports bar where you're hearing, I don't know, Four Non-Blondes or something.
Little Miss Can't Be Wrong.
That's what it is.
Spin Doctors. Every time we're at that bar, we put in the Spin Doctors. We're like, this just makes us laugh at this. Oh, the only song, the only band that plays at this bar is the Spin Doctors.
The kind of thing that you hear in the background, and it's like it's so familiar to you, you don't even hear it. But then if you suddenly hear it for some reason, it's so annoying and it won't stop or go away.
Yeah. So that was, yeah. I mean, I think we use music, you know, we have an incredible music supervisor named Manish Ravel, and he has an excellent taste. And, you know, we want the show, we're trying to thread a needle, which is a show about midlife that's also kind of cool. I mean, we have two stars who are cool. We're not cool, but we're trying to make something that's cool. And sorry, I'm not cool. You're cool.
I'm so cool.
You're so cool. But we're trying to make it cool. And a lot of that's done through music. And so we want the soundtrack of the show to be cool. And Manish finds a lot of amazing kind of alt rock, like indie rock songs.
Oh, there is that. Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. But there's also those moments of kitsch where you go, oh my God.
That makes the comedic songs pop more than the songs that are chosen for comedic reasons pop more. You know, more as a viewer, because you're like, wait, this isn't the sound of the show. And so you realize that while we are huge fans of the Spin Doctors, that's not the point that we're trying to make.
No. But it also points to the way that so much of this show, it operates in this kind of a daytime beige kind of suburban place, or pastel, I suppose. Beige is a loaded word that I don't mean to sort of load it with all of that, but you know what I mean? And I think that, and I was just also wondering if this could be a show that could possibly be set in New York or Chicago or somewhere, because I don't think it could. And it reminds me very much of Australian suburbia and Australian cities. It's bright and kind of pastel.
Yeah. Yeah, we really tried to make it a very Los Angeles specific show, which isn't to say like you have to know Los Angeles intimately to understand or follow what's happening in the show. But in the way that Los Angeles is a city, it's not the only one, but a city that's very diffuse and where people can live like completely different lives within the same city limits. And they can be having like an urban downtown, like super late night kind of artsy life, or they can have a life where they live with their family in a bungalow and walk their children to school every morning, all contained within the city, is what we're going for there.
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, there is a certain kind of suburbia. And I actually, a number of years ago, I was in Sydney and I went to the beach, the famous beach that's there. And it was Bondi Beach, and it was so familiar. It felt so, I was like something like, I think I'm back in Southern California. Like it was like just obviously it looks different. There's other, it doesn't look exactly the same, but there's a similar, it just looks kind of similar. It's the Pacific Ocean. It's very sunny. It has a similar vibe to it.
Yeah. Speaking of Australia and Australians, Rose Byrne, it's interesting. It's not the first time she's kept her accent in something, but tell me about that decision to have her keep her accent. And actually, it's an accent that slips and slides all over the place, which speaks to her character, obviously being a long-term American resident. But there are these moments where she doesn't pronounce the R on the end of the word and so forth. So, what was that decision about?
I mean, I've worked with her, you know, the first comedy she was in was Getting to the Greek, which she, you know, she played a pop star in that. I remember she had just done dramatic stuff. So when she came in to audition for that, I was like, why is Rose Byrne coming to this? And then she was like the funniest human out.
Oh, and she won Best Actress. Remember, she was awarded Best Actress very early on at the Venice Film Festival for The Goddess of 1967. I mean, you know, totally comes to her career and comedy with all these kind of acting accolades.
Yes, off of that, she was cast in Bridesmaids, and then I cast her in Neighbors. And Neighbors, Seth and I were like, we think you should have an Australian accent in that, just because we should have your original accent, just because it's like, I don't know why. There's something it kind of went hand in hand with the character. It made it kind of loosened it up in some way. And then for this too, we were just like, I don't know. There's something fun about her using her. I mean, she could also totally play a full American. There's not like, it's not like she doesn't have the skill set to, you know, she can switch back and forth pretty easily, but there was something, I love the Australian accent. I think it's like, love it. I don't know.
Charming and adorable.
Yeah.
She has her accent and stuff. I mean, and LA is a city full of international people. We know a million Aussie people who live here. It's not an unrealistic thing. And for that reason, we thought it was just like one more kind of fun point of friction between Rose and Seth.
Guys, it's been great talking to you. It's a wonderful show. I think it's a really good watch. And it does have laugh out loud moments. You'll be happy to hear me say, I laugh out loud.
We are happy.
I'm so glad. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. Husband and wife showrunners and directors Nicholas Stoller and Francesca Del Banco. Their show Platonic is available to watch over at Apple TV. That is it for another episode of The Screen Show. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett and to ABC Radio National's arts editor Rhiannon Brown. I'm Jason DeRosso. Let's go out with some music from the rather eclectic soundtrack to Platonic. This track is called Beaches. It's by British singer-songwriter Biba Doobie. I think I'm getting that right. I'm not sure. It doesn't really roll off my tongue very easily. It is a song, though, I really like. Very summery, so it suits the season well. I hope you're having a good one. Bye for now.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.